From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. What's the best way to turn around an underperforming school? The Maryland State Board of Education appears to be ready to consider some ideas that would represent a marked departure from past practices. One of those ideas is to create a special district or a series of special districts that would include all of the schools with students who are not succeeding. What does that mean for local control of schools? How would that affect Governor Larry Hogan's plan to expand vouchers for private schools? And what will the Trump administration's priorities be if Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is confirmed? Liz Bowie covers education for the Baltimore Sun. David Steiner is the executive director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. They join me to talk about what might be next for students in Maryland when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We are broadcasting live from Baltimore. Depending on what park bench you sit on, it's the city that reads. If they haven't painted over those yet, it's the greatest city in America. I'm not exactly sure what the slogan is right now. I mean, Mayor Pugh may have ideas about the new slogan. One slogan I'm almost certain will not be on the back of the park benches is the bedbug capital of America, because Baltimore just yesterday was cited by the Orkin Pest Control Company as the number one city for bed bugs in the United States of America. We've leapt up. We were number nine last year. This year, we're number one. We've beat Chicago, who has been the leader for the last 4 years. Now, there's a couple of things that come to mind. First of all, Orkin gets this data based on the number of bed bugs that they eliminate in various cities. So if they're in charge of eliminating it, why is Baltimore number one? I mean, at number two, not that I would ever cast aspersions on any corporate giant of American commerce. However, you know, they say that we have more bed bugs than everybody, and the implication seems that, you know, perhaps we would like to call Orkin to get rid of it. But anyway, so now here's the good news, though. We are not going to spend the hour discussing bed bugs. All right, so I can hear the sighs of relief in automobiles and offices across this great land of ours. In fact, we are going to have a conversation about education and some ideas that are floating around that could radically alter the way that Maryland approaches the thorny problem of underperforming schools. So today, Education Week has issued its annual rankings of state school systems. We may be number one in bed bugs, and from 2009 through 2013, we were number one in the rankings on state school systems. This year, Maryland is number five. We fell from fourth place where we finished last year. Liz Bowie, who writes about education for the Baltimore Sun, reports that the Maryland State School Board may consider a proposal to establish one or more independent boards to oversee failing schools. So those schools could even be grouped together across jurisdictional lines in one statewide district. Governor Larry Hogan has proposed expanding vouchers for private schools. He wants to double funding for vouchers, up to $10 million. He's also got some ideas about how Maryland should comply with the new federal education law known as ESSA, E-S-S-A, the Every Student Succeeds Act. That replaces the No Child Left Behind Act, but it hasn't ended the debate about how student performance should be assessed and whether or not the metrics used to evaluate students and teachers should be generated locally or at the national level. And speaking of the national level, if Betsy DeVos is confirmed as Donald Trump's Secretary of Education, what will that mean for schools in Maryland and across the country? When Trump discussed education on the campaign trail, he repeated his call to repeal Common Core. Well, Common Core, however, isn't a federal program. It's a set of standards that students should meet that have been adopted by 40 states, including Maryland. Trump claims he supports local control of schools and expanding charter schools. So will that align with what Governor Hogan wants to do, and how might that inform what the Maryland State School Board might want to do to place more kids in the top ranks of academic achievers? Liz Bowie from The Sun does join me here in the studio, along with David Steiner. He's the executive director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy. Before coming to Baltimore, he served as the education commissioner for the state of New York. Welcome to you both, and thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday, our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Liz, these education rankings by Education Week magazine, do you think they're very important?
No, I don't think they're very important. I think they're one of those. I think they're interesting to look at, but I don't think that because a state is ranked number 5th or number 10th, that it means that they have public schools in that order. Mm-hmm. I think there are great public schools and bad public schools in every state.
And David Steiner, I mean, when you look at the criteria that they use, right. Things like the Chance for Success Index and the Achievement Index, does it ring true to you as a scholar of the subject?
Unfortunately not. When we look at the NAEP rankings, that's the National Assessment of Educational Progress, often considered the gold standard across the United States, Maryland's position is dead center, to summarize the results in math and English, mostly in the mid-20s. That means that a state that's one of the wealthiest in the United States is offering an education that is absolutely average in a country that has been sinking in its international standing. So if you put all of that together, we have absolutely nothing to be complacent about. And the results in this city are tragically low, as they are, it must be said, in other places with deep concentrations of poverty. Mm-hmm. That is one of the most difficult challenges we face in public education.
Yeah, obviously some of the more wealthy counties and jurisdictions are going to have higher rankings.
Of course.
And places that are dealing with a number of low-income students are going to have a worse time. But let's talk, Liz, about a couple of these proposals. You wrote a piece about this in The Sun a week or so ago. This notion of statewide districts and the notion of having districts that include just these underperforming schools. Explain how that might work and what various iterations of those plans there might be out there.
Okay. First of all, I think we should say that these ideas are really just ideas floating around right now. They're ideas that some members of the state school board are talking about, but there's no consensus yet on the state school board. There's been no lengthy open discussion of them. So we really have no idea whether any of these will happen. One of the proposals that's been tried in other states, for instance, Tennessee, is that you could take a percentage, say the lowest 5% of lowest performing 5% of schools, and put them in one district that cross different boundaries and try
to. So they wouldn't physically be moved, but they would just be considered all one district and they'd be run by one person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. And that may or may not work. It's, they're different. It's been successful and not successful depending on where you are in the country. They could also just do it in Baltimore City or Prince George's County or Dorchester County, places where there are a considerable number of lower performing schools.
So, for example, if they were to do that, they could take Baltimore, they could have a section, they could have part of the school, some of the schools in Baltimore City would be considered this separate district from the Baltimore City public schools. It'd be a totally different
run by a
universe.
Different, yes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that could happen would be that you could take a group of schools in a particular school district or in the state and put them give them to a charter operator. They could all become charter schools. In New Orleans, after the flood, basically every school in New Orleans now is charter.
Yeah, and they had a term for it. They called it the recovery district.
That's right.
Recovering from Katrina.
Right. Yeah.
I would add that compared to the Tennessee results, it's really the New Orleans story that people point to as the great success. The results now are very close to the state average, and given the poverty index at the city level, it's a remarkable achievement. The politics around the Achievement School District in Tennessee have been very complicated, and while there's been some progress, particularly for the schools that have been doing it longer, it's bumpy. And there are, I think, lessons to be drawn about how to create these districts if one was to go about doing so. And I think there are strong arguments in favor of it. But it's not a simple silver bullet. There is no such thing in American education.
So, Liz, in the New Orleans model, they were all not only lumped into one district, but weren't they a district before? I mean, wasn't the city of New Orleans?
Yeah, there was a normal public school district the way we have in Baltimore City right now.
So they didn't do anything in terms of, you know, slicing up a district and having some schools go one place and another set of schools go another. But they did make them all charter schools.
Right.
That's different than creating districts, isn't
it? Right. They gave – I don't want to get too much into the weeds here. But, no, they didn't just – make them charter schools. They gave a separate authority over those schools. It was a different office, a different set of personnel than the regular.
And I'm sorry, separate from whom?
From the old school district.
So what did the old school district end up doing?
The old school district, no, it has a small number of schools that it maintains. And in fact, under state law, the charter schools will be returned to a public authority within the next 2 years. So this was a timed experiment, if you will. But it's important to note that it wasn't just that a whole set of schools became chartered. They actually did enter into a different structure.
And charter schools, Liz Bowie, in Maryland are somewhat different than charter schools in other places in the country, right? I mean,
yes. In Maryland, one of the things that's different is that all of the charter operators are local school boards. So if you want to open a charter school in your schools, in your county, you have to go through the school board. And lots of school boards really don't want to open charter schools because they're competition sometimes. So in some school systems, it's been difficult to get approval from the school board. In Baltimore City, it hasn't been. There's been much more. The school board has been very open to charters. And so there are 30-some charters now in Baltimore City. A lot of people believe, or some people believe, that the strength of Maryland's law is that that there's a great deal of oversight of charter schools. So some states in the country, you can basically open a charter school if you just apply. You don't have to have any educational background. There's very little oversight. You can have a failing school that continues that way as a charter for years and nobody intervenes. In Maryland, that doesn't happen as often. There's much more, much greater oversight.
I would say that while oversight is very important, and in many states it is first rate, though in others, as you rightly say, Liz, it's not. I mean, Arizona was a case in which you could really open a school if you could smoke a mirror. But in many states, Massachusetts, New York, others, there are very stringent controls on opening charter schools. I think the bigger problem and why Maryland's charter school law is ranked near the bottom of the United States is that the teachers have to be part of collective bargaining. That means that unlike in almost all other states that have charter schools, those who run them are not free to make just a fully open selection as they wish to create the schools they want. Now, that's a very deep set of arguments about whether you believe that all teachers teaching with public dollars should be part of a union or not. But if you speak to charter operators, and there's been some work on this, if you talk to some of the top folks whose charter networks are high performing, they will always say that's one of the reasons they're reluctant to come to Baltimore or to Maryland. So it's both the fact that in Baltimore, it's of course, North Avenue that is authorizing those charter schools, and that's a challenge for some operators, but it's also the fact that there are constraints on who you can employ.
Maryland Department of Education says that there are now 49 public charter schools in Maryland. Does that mm-hmm. sound like a right number?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So 30 of those are in Baltimore.
Yes.
Yeah, it may be more, actually,
yeah.
I think
it's more. That we enroll about 20,000 students in four districts that currently have charters. And in Washington, D.C., for example, there are twice that number of students
right.
in charter schools. So there are places who are embracing this notion of charters in a much bigger way than Maryland.
There are. It's about 10% of Baltimore students are in charter schools, which is much lower than D.C. I think think people point to Washington, D.C., Boston, New Orleans. There's been research from Stanford, the so-called Credo study, that looked across all of the major urban districts. And the consensus research is that for underprivileged students, particularly those of color, in many, many of these urban centers, the results have been much stronger. The pushback has been, of course, on percentage enrollment for special needs students is a little bit lower in many cases than the regular schools and ELL students, and some questions about taking students later on in their school career, so-called backfilling, where you have empty seats. But frankly, the research for African-American students in inner cities is pretty compelling in our judgment at the Institute.
Four charter schools.
Four charters.
And I would say that's debated hotly.
Mm-hmm. And under this plan, and again, we'll emphasize that this plan is just in the ether at the moment.
Right.
It's not a plan, really. It's a mischaracterization even to call it that. But under this idea that some have floated about these districts that would be comprised of the lowest performing schools, it's possible in the city of Baltimore that some would be charter schools and others would be non-charter, just regular
public
schools.
Exactly, exactly. And you could, you know, the legislature could decide that it wants to set up a separate authorizer. So, like, give Johns Hopkins the ability to authorize charter schools and oversee them. In, for instance, Michigan, they do a lot of universities are the authorizers.
New York also.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. SUNY.
So that could be a possibility, yeah. Right.
Well, like it says on my Facebook page, it's complicated.
Yeah.
Doesn't actually say that on my Facebook page. I've been married for 30 years. It's not at all complicated.
I would point out, actually, that in Tennessee, you mentioned Tennessee earlier, there are a group of schools in Memphis that are not charter schools, not part of the new district of charter schools, but it's so-called I-zone, where principals have a lot more authority than they did in the old system. They can hire the teachers they want. They've got full discretion over their budgets, over timetables and what's taught. And those schools have actually done better based on the recent research than those in the recovery district, so at the achievement district. So it's complicated.
David Steiner is the executive director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. Liz Bowie reports on education for the Baltimore Sun. We'll have more on fixing what ails schools after a quick break. We'll take your questions and comments as well. 410-662-8780 to get in touch with us here at Midday. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back. Glad you're with us. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, the saga of State Center in West Baltimore, a deal to redevelop and modernize state offices and add housing and shopping and restaurants, has been in the works for years. Bob Ehrlich was for it. Martin O'Malley was for it. Larry Hogan, well, apparently not so much. Hearings have been held. Contracts have been signed. Lawsuits have been filed. It's a mess. We'll fill you in on the latest developments in this so far undeveloped project tomorrow, right here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about ways to improve student performance at failing schools and how the requirements of the new federal education bill and a new crew at the Federal Department of Education may affect education policy here in Maryland. My guests are the former Education Commissioner of the State of New York, Dr. David Steiner, who now serves as the Executive Director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. Liz Bowie joins us in Studio A as well. She's an education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. So what do you think about how we should evaluate the performance of students in our schools and how should we improve those schools where students aren't doing very well? You can give us a call here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. So Liz, why are these ideas being thought about now? I mean, what has caused you wrote a story where you were very clear that, you know, this is just, it hasn't been discussed publicly or anything, but clearly it's in the ether and your sources are telling you that this is something that people are talking about. What's occasioning all of these new looks?
We are in this place because we have now a new law, a new federal law that replaced the No Child Left Behind law. And so the State Board of Education has to decide how we're going to grade schools, how we're going to assess students, how we're going to assess teachers. And in that very complicated document that they're going to hand to the federal government in September, they have to say how they're going to deal with low-performing schools. So that's one reason. The other reason is that after 20 years of education reform, we really haven't figured out how to improve low-performing schools on – I mean, certainly low-performing schools have improved in somewhat, but we haven't figured it out completely, and there hasn't been enough progress. So there are some who argue that the only times we've seen real progress for low-income students is when we've integrated schools, and that, you know, until we break up schools with very high concentrated poverty, we're not going to see huge gains for those students, and that when they're sitting next to students whose parents are more apt to demand better education, that kids would have a better chance. Mm-hmm.
David Steiner, the No Child Left Behind Act was passed in 2002. That happened kind of coincidentally to coincide with the Thornton Commission's recommendations, which have been in place here in Maryland. Governor Hogan has appointed a new commission, relatively new, which you serve on, called the Kerwin Commission. Britt Kerwin is the former chancellor of the University of Maryland system. So there's two issues, it seems to me. One is how to fix the schools, and the other is how to decide which schools need fixing. I mean, how to evaluate what's working and what's not.
That's the right question. Let me approach it this way. Compared to their international peers at every income level, American students are underperforming. It's a myth to say that it's simply our lowest income students. In fact, our highest income students are doing worse relative to their peers than our lowest income students. What is also true and tragically true.
Let me make sure I understand it. Highest income students are doing worse compared to the high income students in other countries?
In Singapore, Shanghai, and so forth, relative to the poorest. On the other hand, and equally disturbing, if not more so, is that our lowest performing students are achieving at a level that means future employment at any income that will enable them to have a family and sustain that family in a reasonable way is just out of reach. In Baltimore, we're looking at proficiency rates below 15% on many of the Park assessments, and that the city has 85% of its students who are not able to achieve proficiency will perpetuate a cycle of unemployment and poor life outcomes that is a deep, deep tragedy for all of us. And that's, I think, why we're most concerned about those lowest performing schools. But there's a lot of complacency in suburbia, if I can put it that way, and some evidence that increasing percentages of middle class children are coming home to live with their parents because they're no longer competitive in the job market.
So let me ask you about this notion of creating these districts mm-hmm. that would comprise just the low-performing schools, however we decide what the metric for that is. Doesn't that run the risk of ghettoizing these schools? I mean, literally, just putting all the kids who are mm-hmm. not doing well in one clump. Is mm-hmm. that a good idea? Because what Liz
Absolutely.
Is just talking about, mm-hmm. integration of students that perform at all levels, mm-hmm. is one way that has been proven to lift those kids at the bottom.
So it's true that integration under certain circumstances helps the performance of minority students who are now sitting next to those who've had greater advantages. It's not a huge impact. The research over many years has shown modest impact for that result. It's positive, but it's modest. I think, first of all, we shouldn't think that charterizing all students is the only way to improve their education. That would simply be false. We know, for example, that giving students world-class curriculum that giving their teachers real clinical training before they enter the classroom, giving principals the tools to be instructional leaders. These and other things make big differences too. In fact, there's an argument that curriculum is far more important than we've realized. So it's not charters or nothing. But I think the problem has been that for year after year after year, we have these failing schools. Now, some argue we need more money, right? That was in some ways what the commission was looking at the other day under the recommendations of consultants. The problem is there's just no correlation between another dollar spent and better results. There's clearly a baseline below which you cannot educate. But these other issues about the caliber of the teachers and what they're teaching turn out to matter much more.
David Steiner is the executive director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. He's here in studio along with Liz Bowie, education reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. You're welcome to join us. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Liz Bowie, let's talk about money since David brings that up. What would the effect of these districts, for example, or any of the other ideas that they're floating around now have on the school funding formulas? The Thornton Commission was very specific about how the money's supposed to be divvied up. We talked a lot about school funding during the mayoral campaign because of, among other things, Port Covington, which was thought to be, you know, if it's this boon for South Baltimore and all of a sudden the property taxes go up and the revenue comes in, it's going to reduce. It stood the chance, at least, of reducing the funding for schools in the city of Baltimore. What do you see as the possible consequences here?
Wow, a really difficult question because it all would depend on how such a district is structured. There's a huge fight right now, a lawsuit, in fact, between the charter school operators in the city and the city school system over funding. So that would be a difficult issue to iron out.
Where does that stand, by the way? Dr. Santelises, who was on this show, you know, a couple of months ago, sort of said, "Well, we're working on it. We're hoping to get it good." But do you see any, David? Do you see any end in sight?
I'm not privy to any of these conversations. I hope they solve it because we've got to get back to the work of educating children, and then this is a huge distraction. I agree with Liz. The funding issues depend on exactly, you know, the small print and the large print. In theory, if you lose a student from your district and you lose exactly the amount of money you would have spent educating that student, then it should be a wash. But that's never the case. These things are clumsy tools, and there are fixed costs and there are variable costs. We don't want to bore your listeners, but in many, many states, for example, there are funds to help new charter schools with their physical plants, not in Maryland, another reason for the ranking. But I think the devil's in the details, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And the tension, the inherent tension between the charters and the non-charter public schools. They're all public schools.
Right.
But the tension, has come to fore in several, you know, well-publicized instances. I mean, earlier in 2016, right after the first of the year, over in Greenmount West, there's a Montessori charter school there. And the school board decided that, I guess, only 10 students or something from the Greenmount West neighborhood could attend that school. The rest of the people in that school, the kids from that school, come from citywide. Right? So then we have all these children in Greenmount West who live right next to the school who can't go there, who have to take a bus or walk across North Avenue to the Nichols School, which is, you know, several
Dallas
blocks away.
Yeah.
And it's a dangerous trip to walk over there. And if they miss the bus and it's just that whole accessibility of charters is a real problem.
Well, one of the reasons that the city didn't want to allow more students from the neighborhood to go to that Montessori school was because they felt it would be detrimental to the local public school that would struggle. It would lose students and therefore struggle and have to close. And they felt that was unfair to that school. So that school fought very hard to limit the number of students. It's really
you help one and you can't help but hurt another.
I think
that's a tough balance.
I think one of the more important issues in terms of funding comes up in the voucher discussion about whether public money should be used for private education.
Right, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. First, I want to mention an email from Gene who says, how does special education fit in, and how do these ideas affect kids with IEPs, which I guess are individual education plans?
Yes.
David Steiner, how do you think?
Really good question. It's been a challenge for many, particularly smaller charter schools. And there's rightly a real concern about the fact that in many cases they've taken a smaller percentage of these students. The argument is complicated because you want to give absolutely the best possible resources to such students, and often the larger schools are in a better position to do that and, of course, get funding to do that. In some cases, that gap has closed in some areas of the United States, and I think that's a healthy development. But in theory, what you really want to know is there the support wherever the child is, right, for that child? And that's a question that's hard to answer in generalities.
On 88.1, it's Midday with Tom Hall here in the studio with Liz Bowie and David Steiner. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones to Carrie in Towson. Carrie, welcome to the show. You're on with Liz Bowie and David Steiner.
Hi. I just want to make 2 points and then I'll take my answer off the air. I was wondering if Dr. Steiner could discuss the foundations that actually fund his institute and their neoliberal philosophy, which includes, you know, wanting to privatize public monies and through charters and vouchers, because when I look at their website, those foundations are all neoliberals that have that as a goal. And then number two, for Liz, I was wondering if she could address the grassroots parent movement of fairtest.org, which is a parent-led grassroots movement that questions the validity of all fill-in-the-bubble tests.
Right.
All right, so fairtest.org, mm-hmm. Let's take that up. Secondly, David Steiner, the Institute for Education Policy at Hopkins. You receive funding from various people to support your work. Your response to Carrie.
So first of all, just not accurate. For example, Baltimore Promise funds one of our researchers and is not, to my knowledge, on the record in any way.
That's a coalition of a number of different
Open Society and many others. It is absolutely true that some of the funders who've asked us for particular research projects do have a pro-charter view. We, as a university institute, stand by the caliber of our research. If there was a question about that, then we're responsible for it. We will never change one iota of what we write based on any political view of anybody. And in fact, we've taken some unpopular stances that neither side, if one wants to characterize sadly this as a zero-sum debate, is in favor of. For example, we've pushed very hard on the view that this country's more or less disdain for a real use of outstanding curriculum rather than leaving it up to everybody to just decide or use old textbooks has been probably the most damaging of our current education.
You say that there are proven outstanding curricula that could be employed. We know what they are. We know how to teach it. We know what the subject should be. And everybody's ignoring that and coming up with their own thing based on local.
We have most recent research from Tom Kane at Harvard, others from Pat Chingos and Russ Whitehurst and many others. And when we look at the top performing countries in the world, they're very different from each other, right? Finland and Switzerland, South Korea and Shanghai, what they all have in common is that they take this issue extremely seriously. In the end, what matters is how well you teach and what do you teach. And so our institute is by no means one that fits in comfortably to the current debate. But the reason we point to the Credo research in the case of charter schools is it's the best research we know. If there were better research, we would use it.
So, Liz, the bubble test, the famous bubble test. I mean, as we've alluded to earlier today, kids in Maryland not doing very well on any kind of test these days. They're really deplorable rates. I mean, I think the Maryland State Board's goal for next year is to have 40% or something like that?
Well, no, we have 40%.
So they're trying to get it up
to 60 or 70, yeah.
Heaven forbid we should have all the kids, you know, actually pass the test.
On the other hand, it's very difficult to move the dime. And, you know, what we did with No Child Left Behind is say that by a certain date, every child in the country will pass this test, which was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some reality check in there. There are a lot of parents who say we don't want our children taking any standardized tests. There's certainly been a pushback against testing, particularly high stakes testing in high schools. There was recently a report this summer about from a testing commission in Maryland, Interestingly, it's not the state test and the federal required tests that take up as much time in as the local tests. Mm-hmm. And when you actually ask local superintendents to let go of some of their tests, they don't want to. So I think that what's going to have to happen if parents really don't want all this testing, they're going to have to push their local school boards to stop the testing.
Liz Bowie writes about education for the Baltimore Sun. David Steiner is the executive director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. We'll have more on new ideas for educating our kids when we return from a break. 410-662-8780 is what you can call to get in on the conversation. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address, our Twitter handle at Midday Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, my guests are Liz Bowie of the Baltimore Sun and David Steiner, who's on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins School of Education, where he directs the Institute for Education Policy. We're talking today about, among other things, how to improve the performance of kids who are not meeting the marks in our public schools. An advocacy group called EdChoice says that there are roughly 400,000 children in 29 states who attend private schools with vouchers issued by those states. Governor Hogan has proposed doubling funding for the Maryland voucher program, up to $10 million. What do you think about that? We welcome your questions and comments. We'll talk about this and other issues in education. 410-662-8780, our email address midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at @MiddayTomHall. So let's talk about Governor Hogan's plan, Liz Bowie, extend this voucher program. The voucher program is for private schools. It is separate and distinct from the issue of charter schools, is it not?
It is. There were advocates who've tried for years and years to get money put in the budget to allow students who wanted to go to private schools to have some of that private school to tuition to be paid by the state. And for the first time last year, almost $5 million was put into the budget for that. And so it's called the Boost Program. There's a lot of discussion about whether this should be called a scholarship or a voucher program, but it's essentially a voucher program. And there were most of the students got, you know, it depended on your income, and you had to be essentially poor to get some of the money, and most of it went to Catholic and Jewish schools.
960 of the students who received the scholarships or the vouchers are white, 937 are African American, 346 are Hispanic. More than 1,900 students were enrolled in private school during the 2015-16 school year. So, Dr. David Steiner, the obvious problem with this, or the obvious mm-hmm. argument against, is that it cannibalizes mm-hmm. public schools. It takes money away from public education and directs it to private mm-hmm. education.
So there are a couple of issues. The first is, does it actually work? And frankly, the research on vouchers is extremely mixed. Secondly, the question of what happens to the school that gets the voucher. In many states, there's no real public accountability. At a very minimum level, it seems to me that you must insist on public exams for those schools receiving the money. Now, some private schools balk at that idea, well, in that case, again, speaking personally, I don't think they should even be considered for the funding because these are public dollars. Again, the devil's in the details. Depending on the structure of the plan, you can perhaps increase the likelihood that those students will get a better education. But I do want to say, again, simply on the research record, that it is extremely mixed.
Too early to tell, or just...
Yeah, but I mean, that excuse runs out at some point. And again, we're looking at city to city, state to state. You see real differences in the results. And the last thing I would say is that when you look at something like the Boost program, the challenge is if you make it something like $1,400 a student, that is simply not enough to enable a very poor family whose child is in a public school to afford a private school tuition. So ironically, you're almost better off not doing it. Or if you believe in vouchers, you've got to do more financially.
410-662-8780 is our number. Midday at WIPR.org is our email. At Midday Tom Hall is our Twitter handle. Let's go back to the phones. Donna in Baltimore, you've been very patient. Welcome to Midday with Liz Bowie and David Steiner.
Hi, thanks so much. My mother is a recently retired teacher. She spent over 50 years doing special education. And she had a master's degree and had decades of tenure in various school districts. And even then, right up until her retirement, she also had to supplement her income over the summers with summer school and other programs to make ends meet for those months. So my question is there any sort of study on the efficacy of, you know, correlation between increased teacher salaries and increased teachers, educators' quality of life and the quality of education that then comes out in the classroom? Thanks so much.
David Steiner?
Yes.
Obviously, not every problem can be solved by throwing money at it.
But some perhaps can. So, for example, in Tennessee, very high-performing teachers were given bonuses to move into very low-performing schools. And the results were impressive, although the scale wasn't large. I think that the challenge here is that we have had a universal pay scale in general, where how much you're paid and your increase simply depends on how many years you've been in the system. There are now states such as Iowa that give you the opportunity, if you're willing to take on something like a mentorship role to first-year teachers or a curriculum leadership role. In other words, real career ladders recognized by real salary differentials. Merit pay is very controversial, obviously, because it involves using test data to evaluate teachers. But in general, I think it's one of the last professions where we don't differentiate responsibilities and performance in terms of salary. And finally, I say that the research on this is that it's not just a question of the entering salary. That's less important than the compression. In other words, 20, 30 years later, as an outstanding educator, you're just clearly not making more than the less effective teacher next to you, and you're not making more compared to other professionals.
And Liz Bowie, the Baltimore City Public Schools is certainly wrestling with this. Andres Alonso, he was three CEO
ago.
But he signed a contract with the city teachers union that, you know, did reward people based on the merit and the effectiveness of their teacher and teaching. And now Dr. Santelices, who's the current CEO, is dealing with a huge budget deficit that a lot of people point to that contract. They point to the cost of salaries in the classroom as being a real problem balancing the budget.
Yeah, I think some people believe that Alonso should not have committed the school system to a contract that was just not sustainable over the long term. There's certainly a lot of teachers who've been able to increase their salaries very rapidly in the city. I'm not saying they don't deserve it, but I'm not sure it's sustainable for the long term. And I think that probably the new CEO is going to have to stand firm, because I don't see where she's going to come up with $129 million to make up the difference in the budget for next year.
Got a couple of tweets. Chris treats years of discussions and policies on education. It's all the same, same, same. Standards continue to fall. We're doing everything wrong. Well, bro, that's why we're having this discussion. Thank you for your tweet, but we're trying here. And Melissa writes, apart from ghettoizing failing schools, and we should say that that's my term, not anybody else's, it removes democratic control of schools and lessens community engagement. You know, this is another consequence if we were to make these districts cross jurisdictional lines. If you're a person in Baltimore City and your kid is in one of these districts and the person running that district is in PG County, that's a whole other universe. Let's go back to the telephone lines. We've got Morgan in Baltimore. Morgan, you are an educator. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm a special educator and also an English and drama teacher in the city. And I have a question about the economic implications of the voucher program. If we take as our premise what's happened in higher education, whereas Pell Grants, Stafford loans became more and more available at higher education levels, the cost of higher education increased significantly, like in accordance with the amount of money available. Is it not possible to extrapolate that trend down towards K-12 and say, if we start providing vouchers for private education, the cost of private education would simply increase at the same rate that we are supplying money, and we're not actually going to serve the students who need private education the most, the students who are least well served by the public education in the city?
Well, Morgan, thank you for your call. David Steiner, or Liz Bowie, I mean, Maggie McIntosh, a delegate who's perhaps considering running against Governor Hogan for that office, has some problems with the Boost program, saying that perhaps it will incentivize private religious schools to decrease the amount of scholarship money that they're offered.
Yes, and I think it's interesting to note that the majority of the students who received the aid this school year were already enrolled in a parochial school. So it did not help. I mean, it did help some students who were in low-performing public schools move out of them, but that's not where the majority of the money
That's
went.
Interesting. They were already there.
So they were already simply, there.
Making the burden a little bit less
right. That was my
significant on the families.
Yeah. Earlier, that if the amount of money simply wasn't enough, right, to allow those who didn't have their children there to move them.
Just got a couple of minutes left. Daniel in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Hi, thanks so much. Just want to make a quick comment about the level of the level of passing and failing in Maryland based on the Park exam. I'm a teacher in Baltimore, and up until this year, students were not even required to pass the Park to graduate. They just had to take them. And I know from proctoring these exams, many students were fully aware of it, wanted to get out, done with the exams as quickly as possible, just kind of went C, all the way through. So the fact that so many people are not doing well in the parks is less a symptom of how well our schools are doing than just the fact that the state isn't requiring them for didn't require them for graduation until this very year.
So, Liz Bowie, would that help if they were a graduation requirement?
You could make that argument with except that students in grades 3 through 8 for the last 15 or 20 years have had to take those tests, and they didn't count for anything for them. And we use that data, and the same is true with the Park tests, and the results on the Park are pretty low for those grades as well.
I would also point out that our results on Park are very similar to the results on SAT in terms of college readiness, and NAEP and ACT. All of these assessments line up. I should, as a disclosure, say that I serve on a board that oversees Park. So, but I would not say that the Park assessment is by any means perfect.
Right,
all assessments need improving.
David Steiner is the executive director of the Institute for Education Policy at Johns Hopkins University. Liz Bowie covers education for the Baltimore Sun. Thank you to both of you. We shall have you back and continue this very important conversation. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Tom.
The Maryland State Board of Education is holding a series of listening sessions to get a public input on how the state should comply with ESSA, the new federal education bill that Congress passed in late 2015. We didn't get a chance to talk much about it today, but we'll talk about it later. There's a listening session tomorrow night in Hagerstown in Washington County Board of Education, and another at the Dorchester Career and Technology Center in Cambridge on Tuesday. We've got more information on our website, wipr.org/midday. Lunch for our guests today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street and on the square in Canton, as well as at 810 West West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Tomorrow, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here with her weekly theater review. She'll tell us about Into the Woods at the Kennedy Center, and we'll explore why, after years and years of planning and hearings and contracts between the state and a developer, the plan to revive the aging State Center complex in West Baltimore is still stalled. It's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. Hope you can join us then. Thanks for joining us today. For the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.